This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
In the very first days, Barack Obama was in office in early 2009, began not only a campaign of the use of drones in Pakistan and Yemen that we know some things about, but developed much more extensively than the Bush regime had ever done, a policy of targeted killing. And we've been trying to find out what happens on these so-called Terror Tuesdays, when we're told that every other Tuesday Obama meets with his national security team and signs the death warrants for people known and unknown who are going to be targeted by drone strikes all across the region, and as far as we know, in possibly seven or eight countries with more and more drone bases.
Right, and I think that's really important to point out for those who doubt that this is the new form of U.S. military and its way of dominating the world. You need to look at how many drone bases are being built. I think a lot of Hillary Clinton's job that she finished just fine for Obama was in helping lay the groundwork for this. I know that we're suing one base in Saudi Arabia to try to force them to become our drone base there. And I read that we sent 50 more troops to Niger to join 40 others there because, excuse me, we now have an agreement for a drone base in Niger. This is definitely the use of unmanned aerial vehicles to surveil and to kill and dominate other populations is definitely the agenda of our military right now.
Yeah, well, I think what you're describing is a change.
Yes.
From the Bush regime sending aircraft carriers, B-1 bombers, and huge numbers of, you know, what they call boots on the ground into, first of all, Iraq. And, of course, they thought Iraq was going to be really simple. It would be over in a matter of a few days, and they would have conquered and put fear into the rest of the Middle East. And what they did was really to ignite a firestorm of rage against shock and awe and against the actions of the U.S., and I can't help but remind people that the 10th anniversary of shock and awe is coming up in only 3 weeks. That's March 19th and 20th. And I hope that people listening who care about their responsibilities of living in this country will think seriously about things to do on that day. And if you need ideas, you can look at our website, which is worldcan'twait.net. But this was one approach that the Bush regime had, was occupations, which brought all of the mess of the international so-called global war on terror. That was the targeted assassinations, the indefinite detention, the night raids, the complete destruction of at least two societies in Iraq and Afghanistan.
And we pair the drone bases with special operations teams. And I noticed that in Monday's New York Times, there was an article about how we were driven out of one province by Afghanistan government demanding that we no longer participate there because special forces, along with militias that they've rounded up of Afghanis, have been committing extreme violence against citizens in the area. And there's a lot of detail to that if you want to find it out. But in another page in the paper, I read that the United States has come to agreement with NATO and other forces about how much will be left behind. And what they specifically talk about is that the U.S. forces that will be left behind are exactly these joint special operations killing teams. So I want to talk about that. No matter what they say, they continue to want to operate. And I do believe that that's the way they plan on operating. Beyond the old military was big, you know, heavy aircraft carriers, and we will continue to have those kinds of weaponry. But this is really allows them to go into many countries that they would have never been able to get into before. And I want to remind people, just in 2007, when Obama, as a candidate, said that he would fly into Afghanistan with a drone and take out any appropriate target he saw, the rest of the politicians, including Bush at the time, who was still president, said, oh, that's a violation of other nations' sovereignty. How could you do that? That's not going to happen. And now it's the norm.
I think that's a bit of irony that people should really ponder. And in fact, what we are dealing with is the aftermath, not only of all the destruction that the Bush regime affected, but the aftermath of our own efforts to drive out the Bush regime actually was accomplished by people thinking that they had voted for someone remarkably and at least superficially different in the form of Barack Obama. And it's really important to grapple with the main role of a president being the commander-in-chief of the U.S. empire.
Well, it's certainly...
Lots of things are for domestic consumption, but that role, you know, is really the core of U.S. power.
And the article I read reviewing that 2007 statement by Obama pointed out that that was probably his audition to the just to make sure that the military-industrial congressional complex understood where he was militarily.
Well, very perceptive. Of course, elections I view as mainly auditions for the people in power, and a bit of theater and fiction for the people who are voting.
Well, I'll agree with you on that.
But what Obama has been able to do, and this is, like, I guess, the heart, getting to the heart of what you're raising, is that he has been able to, on the one hand, say, well, we're getting out of Iraq, we're getting out of Afghanistan, we're removing the troops. But indeed, the leaner, meaner fighting machine left are the Joint Special Operations Command troops, the special forces, exactly the ones we saw in Zero Dark 30, so chillingly operating. He's leaving in place the torture. He's leaving in place all of the billions and billions of dollars of pillage that were wreaked on people by the puppet governments of Maliki and Karzai in both of these countries.
Well, and let's talk about... Oh, go ahead. Yeah. Well, go ahead.
Yeah. And then he's expanded, just very briefly, into Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, as you're mentioning, Mali, Niger, probably the Philippines, all the places where this long-distance surveillance and drone war and program of targeted assassination.
You know, I think the American public tends to believe that there's been few targeted assassinations and then there's been other drone attacks in warfare, sort of. But mm-hmm. I, in speaking to a Yemeni activist, Ibrahim Khatabi, a couple weeks ago on my last show, I discovered that there had been 53 drone attacks in Yemen in 2012 alone. Now, I don't know if that sounds shocking to anybody else, but that's a whole lot of drone attacks in one country that we're not at war with. And we've heard famously about the American citizen, and we should hear famously about Awaki, who was killed, and his son later, who was killed by drone attack. But I think it's more important to recognize these other, you know, these 51 other drone attacks and what they create. I want to talk a little bit about, you know, we say, why do they hate us? Well, they hate us because we send in killers to pull out their family members and leave their dead bodies on the side of the road. But they also, the terror that these drones cause has caused the displacement of literally millions of people in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and now in Yemen. The Red Cross is busy in Yemen and all of these locations trying to help displace people who are fleeing where the drones have attacked because they don't know where they're safe.
Right, and the fiction, along with your point, the fiction that's been created in this country is that these are surgical precision strikes only taking out so-called insurgents known to the U.S. And, you know, the Bureau of Investigative Journalism and other groups have done a lot of work to try to uncover, well, in Pakistan, for instance, who are the victims? Come to find out, the U.S. government defines any male over the age of 21 as an insurgent, as a militant, unless proven otherwise posthumously. So this is a whole population, and this is, in fact, genocidal. We know that, you know, so I don't know how appropriate the term civilians even is in this situation when you're talking about a country that's been embroiled in wars and civil wars for decades. But people who are non-combatants and have not attacked the U.S. aren't even involved in any organization that is thinking about that, have been killed, including hundreds and hundreds of children.
And I think just
in the drone strikes, but in the even cruise missile strikes are going into Yemen.
Yes, and I think that if you want to see, and I know I don't mean this in a ghoulish way, but on Code Pink's website, there are a lot of photographs because they've traveled to Pakistan and to Afghanistan, and there are a lot of photographs of civilians who have been injured and or killed by these attacks of these drones. So I think if you need to have a way of showing people the reality of this, you can go to those pictures and show people these pictures and say, it isn't something surgical. Does this look surgical to you? You know, I want to go on, though, because we're talking about drones as a whole, and we're talking really about unmanned aerial vehicles. And there are a lot of different types of those. Some of those are designed to be able to carry weapons, and those are the ones we hear about a lot. Some of them are designed to carry cameras, but not weapons. And they're being designed in all sorts of sizes, shapes, and types. Many of them not specifically for warfare or for law enforcement spying or government spying. And so I wanted to get that in there at this point because it's important to know that the whole, it's like the internet. The genie is out of the bottle and you aren't going to put her back in. There's not going to be an end to all kinds of drones with the amount of technological advancement there's made and the amount of money that's going into developing more and all of the ingenious ways that people are thinking of using them. One of the ways that they're wanting to use them in the United States, and they've actually begun to use them, is in law enforcement. And I know that the upcoming April days of action are also focusing on that. So let's talk a little bit about use of drones, aerial drones, to spy on civilians for either legitimate, quote, legitimate law enforcement reasons or for simply spying on activists. Deborah, this is Linda Olson Osterlin with KBOO, and I'm speaking with Deborah Sweet of The World Can't Wait. Deborah, can you talk about their law enforcement, the potential?
Well, you know, I think it's only bounded by the technology, and this is growing so quickly. And as you said, there's so much money in it. The major investor in drone technology in this country, of course, is the Department of Defense. And there are implications for this technology in government surveillance and warfare all the way through what appears to be perhaps a benign application. Could be transferred in the hands of a police state. And you look at a situation now, Linda, in this country where it's the government that has all the privacy and the people, you know, who have no protection of our privacy.
Well, and I know of one case I covered a while ago. I think it was in Reno, Nevada. They used a drone to pop up and look in someone's backyard and see a grow operation happening and followed through with an arrest. The case was challenged on that it was an invasion of privacy, that they should have had to have had a warrant to go into this person's backyard. And the court ruled that, no, they didn't have any reasonable right to expect privacy of that sort. And so that was a lower court, but that's going to make its way up through the cases. And I do believe that I saw the Supreme Court ruled on a different kind of spying case. That's where the NSA is listening in on or getting a feed of all calls that go through any one of our cell phone lines. Yes, people, every type. And the question was, can you sue them for invasion of privacy? And the Supreme Court said, not unless you can prove you were harmed by the spying.
Right. That's the heart of the case that progressive journalists are trying to bring, in fact, against the government right now. And they're being shut down because the government is saying, you can't prove you were a target because this is a secret program.
Right.
So then, you know, and this really gets very Orwellian.
It does, exactly, because you can't prove that, and you can't prove harm if you can't prove how the use of that spying harmed you. Though, of course, there can be, and there is a real case to be made, that just knowing that you are observed changes your behavior and that that's harm. But so we're talking about police departments probably all over the nation wanting to use these. I do have some good news for Oregonians, at least at this stage. There are two bills in the Congress, a new legislative session that's set, one by Senator Floyd Prozanski and one by Representative John Huffman. The Prozanski one is to limit any spying on citizens with the use of aerial drones. And I believe the one John Huffman covers that to some degree, but it's also making it a crime to outfit drones with weapons to shoot on citizens or with cameras to spy on citizens. So we have a couple legislatures who are wanting to get some limits and restrictions on drones, which I think is an important thing. It leads me to want to talk about the April Days of Action, because I noticed that this organization, the Network for Stopping Drone Spying and Warfare, is doing a whole month of activities, and they're targeting different aspects of the making of drones and the utilization of drones. Can you talk about the April Days of Action and what's planned?
Yeah, well, this is a huge effort, as you said, I think, at the beginning, a political uprising against drone warfare and spying. And we're really going after the people living in this country, their minds, actually, to open up their minds to what is being done, both in their name and behind their backs and behind the scenes. We are politically challenging three different institutions here broadly. At the beginning of the month, the 4th through the 7th of April, around the country, we're going to be protesting at drone manufacturers, which, of course, are all the major defense and military contractors, including some new ones that have come in the last few years, because there is just so much money coming from the government.
So while I've got you there, I did do a little research here in Oregon about manufacture, and we do have a lot of manufacturing or of parts of systems going on. The biggest company that we have here in Oregon, and I'm telling you activists this, you can find this out yourself, but I know there's a lot of peace activists out there who might be interested in participating in these with this network in the April Days of Action, and I want to let you know that there are manufacturers to address. In situ is one, and you know, it took me a while to find out they were a Boeing subsidiary. Maybe I should have known that, but Boeing is their parent company, and their largest location near us is in Bidingen, which is just across the river from Hood River, about, 45 miles to 60 miles from here. They also have an address in Oregon. I went out there in Hood River. I went out there to try to find it, drove around for hours, asked people, couldn't find it. I did find out, however, that another one of our intrepid cable reporters has located that place, and I'm sure she'll be reporting on that in the future, so I'll leave that to her. But I want to say it's not a large manufacturing facility here, but in situ is one of those organizations that they feel proud of their service with the United States military, and they talk about in their website having forwarded over 250 missions in Iraq and Afghanistan. So they're very much a directly war-related industry that's located here in the Northwest. Beyond them, there's one called, the other next big one is Northwest UAV Propulsion Systems, and it's called Northwest UAV. And they're making propulsion systems. They're out in McMinnville. They had plans for a large facility. Once again, I didn't actually get to see it, so there's a lot of research to do. But in the listing of this, I just want to say quickly, Oregon people will recognize these names of other kinds of entities that are involved in research and development of systems to work with drones of all sorts of types. I want to include in here ones that could be used to help fight forest fires, ones that could be used to locate herds of elk that may be, caught in a snowstorm, earthquake disaster area research. You could go in and look at those things. There's all sorts of other uses for drones. Oh, and on the seaplanes and unmanned water vehicles as well. And there's a lot of research going into them. I think it would be stupid of us to think that it's all bad because the main use is the police state and what they're doing with it. But here's some of the organizations that are working with it. Evergreen International Aviation says they're the first and only unmanned aerial service provider in the area. Wilsonville-based FLIR Systems builds cameras for high-altitude surveillance. Oregon Ironworks is working on an unmanned seaplane with another organization. CloudCap Technologies of Hood River sells autopilot systems. Northwest UAV Propulsions imports parts from Germany and builds super light efficient engines. There's EOS, Onami, Ricardo, Rapid Manufacturing, Ellipse, Rotrone, Variprop, etc. There is also, so we can see the business is already forged ahead here in Oregon. I'm betting it's like that in many states. Is that accurate, Deborah?
I'm sure it's in every state, and there are known concentrations. And as I said, the money is coming directly from the Department of Defense and probably other government agencies into all sorts of companies. People may not know and understand in terms of the warfighting capability of the U.S. that already there are more drone pilots being trained by the Air Force than pilots of fixed-wing aircraft like B-1 bombers. This is where the technology is going, so that's where the money is going. You're right. In the middle of the month, April 14th through the 16th, we are going to be focusing on drone research. And again, just like the private companies, the university research, both public and private, is just stunning. Hundreds and hundreds of campuses now have DOD contracts for some parts of contributing to research in unmanned vehicles. One of the biggest is Johns Hopkins, where there's already, I'm very glad to say, a group of professors and students and people in the university community who are fighting to expose this program and to get Johns Hopkins out from under it. And you can find out more about all this at nodrones.com, and that's KNOWDRONES.com, which is the landing place for the organizing efforts for the April actions.
And I already have links to that on the website right now. If you go to the schedule where it talks about this show, there are links to it. And when we finish and have the audio from this show uploaded, I will add those links as well. It appears that Oregon State University is the university in Oregon that's most involved. At least that's the one that I could find anything about it. They have a formal agreement that they've made with the Economic Development for Central Oregon, or EDCO is the organization, and they're specifically going into research and development, including things like they want to do testing of sensing devices, far-held sensing devices, and that kind of thing. And that goes into what they're trying to develop in Central Oregon, which I think is what most people have heard knows about here in Oregon. They want to develop a drone test area, test flight area in Central Oregon. And they've already received FAA money to upgrade the airports and the areas around the airport in Bend. And Senator Wyden was there, and this is much talked about as a potential site. When I looked into who has contracts to test drones right now, I did not find one that was linked to Oregon. And when I looked at the sites where they are doing provisional testing, there are no permanent sites yet, they were almost all military. And there were two up in Washington, but there wasn't one listed here. That's information that the Electronic Frontier Foundation published in May of last year, so May 2012. I don't have any more upgrades. But once again, here in Oregon, too, we have universities involved in the development of drones and drone research. And then
I bet this is developing so quickly that I bet intrepid people who want to know could find out the developments that are taking place, you know, by the month.
Yep, exactly. And I think the reason I'm bringing out these specifics about Oregon as you talk about the national activities is I just want to let our Oregon activists know that there's opportunities to take steps in all of these areas and join others who are, for example, protesting at Johns Hopkins.
Yeah, and I want to let lots of people know, including younger listeners, why does it matter what's going on at universities? In 1967, the role of the University of Wisconsin and the University of Michigan with Dow chemical company, which was the producer of napalm being used on civilians and on everybody, wiping out the ecology of Vietnam, was exposed by students who found out that research was going on at these public institutions. There were not only protests, there were riots over this.
Napalm, when we saw what it did, when we saw what it did to people, there was a famous picture of a little girl burnt naked running down the street. And that's why I mentioned those Code Pink photos, because I do think for some people they have to see a photo for it to go, oh, that's a little girl like my granddaughter, or oh, that's just like my neighbor's child.
That's part of what we're doing for these April Days of Action. We're challenging people to be confronted with what your government is doing in your name. It's exactly what's going on. It's just a different form. And it won't stop until we do have a political uprising, and we reject it in our millions. And we're starting here at the end of the month, the 24th through the 27th of April around the country, we'll be focusing on drone bases. Right, the bases, Beale, in Nevada, and Hancock up in New York State. They're spread around the country, and of course, these are not bases where drones are flying from. These are bases where the pilots are located, so that they're targeting people from 18 inches away. Their computer screen to their eyes is 18 inches, but they are killing people halfway around the world.
I think it's really important that you're going to go to those places. I think one of the most important roles, and I remember this from the anti-war movement against Vietnam, is education, education, education. Many of the people working on drones and drone research in this city, they're part of the 99%. They're not the 1%. And we need to take the time to educate them so that they understand what their industry is building, so you know they can make choices. Engineers can make choices. Am I going to work in a war industry or not? You know, I had a husband who was an engineer. I know that these are the kinds of ethical questions they face. So doing education right at the site, letting them know the reality of their behavior is really important, not as an accusation, not to throw it at them, but to ask them to speak to their own humanity.
And they can be part of speaking out as well.
That's right. They can be the people who say, I don't like being part of this. Deborah, we've run out of time. I'm so sorry. I've been talking with Deborah Sweet of The World Can't Wait, and also the Network to Stop Drones. So let's talk about, give me those two websites one more time. It's The World
Can't... Well, you can find World Can't Wait's work, which includes work to stop the U.S. global war on terror, torture, and war, and that's at worldcan'twait.net. And specifically for the April actions and a lot of information about the U.S. drone war, go to nodrones.com, KNOWDRONES.com.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Deborah Sweet. And thank you, KBOO audience, for listening. And thank my great engineer, Rock, for being there. Listen in a couple weeks to hear me again.
And good morning from KBOO Portland. Coming up at 10:15, Flashpoints honors the 40th anniversary of the founding of the American Indian Movement at Wounded Knee. We'll feature an extended conversation with AIM co-founder and Wounded Knee survivor Bill Means. Also, we'll hear excerpts from Welcome to Hebron, which portrays the struggle for Palestinian high schoolers to go to school. At 11 today, on Between the Covers, Ayanna Mathis, author of the best-selling novel The 12 Tribes of Patty, about an African-American family in Philadelphia, talks about her work and career with Bookwaves host Richard Walensky. And at 11:30, hear the film show with SW Concert and Jen Chavez. Coming up next, though, it's headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre on Air Cascadia, right after this on KBOO.
KBOO Radio is a proud sponsor of the 23rd Cascade Festival of African Films, Africa Through African Lenses. The film festival will take place February 1st through March 2nd, 2013, Thursday through Saturdays each week. The majority of films were made by African directors and celebrate Africa's achievements, expose Africa's failures, and reveal the possibilities of change and a more hopeful future. More information on the Festival of African Films can be found at kbo.fm/CFAF23.
Women are murdered by abusive partners every day. Kathleen Blankenship shot her abusive husband, who was also an ex-cop. She was sentenced to life in prison. She will tell you how she broke through the wall of blue and had her murder conviction overturned. Hear her story on Prison Pipeline, March 4th at 6:30 p.m. Talk about your revolution. It's there.